Physics World.
Hello, and welcome to the Physics World Weekly Podcast. I'm Margaret Harris, and although you may not have heard about it yet, this week happens to be a particularly important one in the scientific calendar. No, it's not Nobel Prize Week. That's in October. Instead, it's Peer Review Week, an annual global event that celebrates the essential role that peer review plays in maintaining scientific quality. And here in the virtual studio to talk with me about Peer Review Week are Kim Eggleton and Bahar Mamani. Kim is Research Integrity and Inclusion Manager at IOP Publishing, which, of course, also publishes Physics World. And Bahar is Reviewer Experience Lead at Elsevier. Bahar is also the co-chair of Peer Review Week for 2020 and, I think, a physicist by training.
True. And the correction, I'm co-chairing one of the subcommittees of the organizing committee of 2020.
Okay. Gotcha. Sorry about that. To kick off the discussion, Kim, I think most of our listeners will be familiar with peer review already. In fact, many of them will have probably acted as peer reviewers themselves. But for people who aren't so familiar, who are maybe still early in their careers, could you give us just a short description of what peer review is?
Peer review is the checking and the verification of articles before they end up in a journal. So an article is submitted to a journal, and in order to make sure that the science is valid and that the conclusions, you know, they're justifiable, what we do is we send that paper out to sometimes one, sometimes two, sometimes more, depends. We send that out to people in the same field and ask them, you know, do you think this is worthy of publication? So there are various different methods of doing that, and we'll probably touch on that a little bit later. But that's the basics, nuts and bolts of what peer review is. It's checking by the community that the article does what it claims to do so that it only ends up in the journal if it's rigorous science.
Okay, thanks, Kim. So that's how the system is supposed to work at a sort of 10,000-foot view. But if you talk to some of the scientists who are doing peer reviews or indeed having their work reviewed, you do often hear some complaints about it. I mean, obviously, everybody likes a good moan sometimes, but some of these moans are pretty consistent. I mean, you hear about researchers being swamped with requests to do lots of reviews. You know, they aren't actually paid for doing the reviews, and the other rewards can be kind of nebulous sometimes. And on the side of the reviewed, I guess you hear researchers say that getting their paper reviewed takes a long time. Sometimes the reviewer doesn't understand their work, or they want unreasonable changes. And, you know, there's some really terrible cases out there where the reviewers are even dismissive or abusive to the person being reviewed. Bahar, that's kind of a grab bag of challenges there, but what do you see as some of the biggest challenges facing peer review?
I think in general, we need to first think about different communities having different problems around peer review in general, because for example, the model of peer review that is acceptable in one community changes in another community is a different thing. And then the type of problems are totally different. In physics, for example, single anonymous is the common way of doing review, in the sense that authors don't know the identity of reviewers, but reviewers know who the authors are. And actually, that, for example, brings the problem of reviewers sometimes writing not a courteous review report, not trying to stay objective. And sometimes it's really hurtful to read review reports that is aiming at someone's career instead of the work that has been reported. And that was one of the problems that you mentioned. But then if you look at, for example, social sciences community, there the norm of running peer review is double anonymous. So there, reviewers don't know who the authors are, authors don't know who the reviewers are. And recently, they have also introduced triple anonymous, where actually the handling editor who is deciding what the fate of the manuscript should be also doesn't know the identity of reviewers and authors. So someone like an editor-in-chief chooses the reviewers for the manuscript, and then the deciding editor only decides based on what reviewers have written and what authors have reported. And there, we don't hear much of you know, problems, for example, regarding the way that review reports are being written and the language. Another issue in peer review that many people, particularly editors, refer to is lack of resources, lack of having good pool of reviewers who are willing to review a manuscript and provide feedbacks that are constructive for authors and helpful for editors. And one reason for that is that, unfortunately, historically, journals have been built around a particular geolocation of editorial board members and editors. Most prestigious journals in physics, for example, are from the US or Europe. And I can imagine most editors of these journals are white men in their 50s and 60s who have their own, you know, group of reviewer pool whom they know, and then they usually tend to reach out to them and don't think about expanding this pool beyond their network. And that's why the reviewer fatigue comes into the picture. Review community all the time is complaining about the number of review invites that they receive. And put this next to the fact that journals are also growing. There are now more than 20,000 journals in general. Just on the field, so you can go and choose whatever journal you want to submit to, but then you need to also make sure that the journals have active reviewer pool around it. Another problem that has been pinpointed by researchers during all kind of surveys. I mean, there was Publon's survey in 2019, I guess. No, 2018. And then Elsevier and Sense About Science ran another survey last year. Wiley ran a survey. IOP also ran a survey recently. They all have the same theme around reviewer pain points. Another pain point is about lack of instructions. Most cases, we don't actually learn how to review a manuscript, not even at the university level. So, for example, I started to learn how to write a manuscript when I started to write my manuscripts in my PhD, and that was just by try and error. And it was still doable because I was just sending my draft to my supervisor. My supervisor would send it back to me with lots of red lines, and then I could understand, oh, okay, this needs to be written in a different way. But then when it came to the first review invite I received when I was a postdoc, I was totally in dark. I had no idea what and how should I write and how should I point the author to the things that I had the idea that needs to be done differently. And I couldn't even share my thoughts with someone else in the institute because it is considered as confidential. So that's where lack of resources and instructions are being pointed, because there are no formal courses around peer review in institutions and universities as part of the curriculum, which is, I think, quite an important thing. Journals, publishers run peer review workshops, provide online resource materials. Every publisher has its own online peer review course. You just Google and find them. But it needs to be also part of the curriculum, I think.
Kim, do you have anything to add to that?
I've just been nodding furiously while Bo has been talking there, because there are so many potential issues, and you're absolutely right, Baha. They're so specific sometimes to the subject and the way that historically journals have been created or they've been managed. And you know, I almost think of ourselves at IOP as quite lucky, because we just work really within the physics community. We have some journals that, you know, move into the biological science community and into engineering as well. But for, you know, thinking about it from Elsevier's point of view, you've got social sciences in there. So there's a whole host of challenges for you to grapple with that perhaps we're not struggling with so much. I think that, yeah, that the only thing I would add really is that the issue of recognition for peer review for me is still so unsolved. It's constantly something that we hear about. it's not rewarded. It's not. It's just an expectation that as part of your academic career, you're expected to provide constructive feedback to other academics. And most people are happy with that. But there is a group, and quite justifiably a group, who say, you know what, this is hard work. It takes a long time to provide a constructive review. You need to go away, you need to research it, you need to look at surrounding literature. Those are not free hours, that's not free time. And so how can we ensure that reviewers are incentivized and rewarded to participate in this system? I think we're all in agreement that peer review isn't perfect, but it's absolutely essential. We need science to be verified in some way. And so how do we ensure that that reviewer pool continues to be, that continues to grow, it continues to be diverse, it's representative? And I just don't think we've solved it yet. The surveys that Baha spoke about just a few minutes ago quite often ask about, you know, how would you like to be rewarded for this work? And there isn't really a consensus of opinion. We know that genuine gratitude goes a long way. Reviewers like to be thanked, and that seems like such a small, easy thing to do. And yet I think journals, you know, still have some way to go in doing that. We also know that reviewers like to be kept up to date with what happens. So when they've given their opinion on a manuscript, do we take the time to tell them what's happened? You know, was it ultimately accepted? Was it published? Was it cited? I think there's a lot more that we as publishers can do to make reviewers feel, to keep them up to date with the outcome of the work that they've contributed to. But then we can also think more about the kind of physical rewards that we might be able to give to reviewers. So Publons is a fantastic system, and I know there's another system, Reviewer Credits, that works in a similar way, where reviewers can kind of keep an online database, a list of all their reviewing contributions, and they can then present that when they're going up for tenure or promotion to kind of say, here's the additional contributions I've made. I'm more than my research output. I'm also contributing to research in this way. And this is a really important part of academic life. And so I think those two recognition systems, Publons and Reviewer Credits, are doing some really important work there. And I'm aware there may well be more out there that I've not name checked there. There's also discussions about cash rewards. You know, do discounts help? Does paying reviewers help? I'm personally
there is this 450 movement on Twitter.
Yes,
now.
Yeah. So someone's actually done some calculations.
Do you want to explain what that is?
Go for
it. Do you want to explain what that movement is?
There is basically just the handle 450 movement, which is calling research community to ask journals to sign a contract for paying $450 for each review invitations that they receive, and they agree the invitation once they get the money, the signed agreement document. It has received lots of attention on Twitter nowadays. Yeah.
So what would be the issues with paying that? I mean, obviously it would hit the bottom line of publishers, but are there any other problems with it? I mean, that might be a huge problem, but I'd be interested to see what the other problems are.
I see a big problem with that, which is connected to something we haven't discussed yet, but it is related to recognition, and that is ghost review or co-review, which happens a lot. I did it myself.
What's ghost review? I'm not familiar.
Yeah, I did it myself when I was doing my postdoc. It is when someone who is heading a lab and having a big group as a PI receives a review invite but doesn't have the time to do it, thinks, oh, I've got this postdoc, or someone like junior researcher in my team who is focused on that topic, I know he or she can do it better than me, so I'm going to ask them to review the manuscript. And that's how I started reviewing a manuscript. And of course, it really depends on that PI, whether they really, decline the invite and tell the editor, I know this reviewer, so invite them instead of me, or they just let the review happen in their team and then later on submit the report, but then send an email to editor separately saying, hey, I did it, but together with my team, or just receive the review from their members and submit it, and that's the end of the story. In any case, what happens is that the in general review process doesn't happen the way editors always think, in the sense that they invite someone and they get the review from that someone. No, in most cases, if that someone is a PI, the review is happening by the team members. And now imagine the PI receiving 450, but the one who actually did it never receives even a simple thank you, yet alone the 450. So,
or credit via Publons or something like that.
So
yeah.
It's more than, you know, it's more than just paying reviewers. There are fundamental things that we need to address before choosing a type of recognition, and it's sometimes beyond journals and publishers. Institutions need to change their mind about productivity and all the metrics that they put around it in all their evaluation committees and grant application proposals. And Publons, it was a nice example. I recall someone telling me, I don't feel confident putting my review activities in Publons anymore because my supervisor is also on Publons. And once he came to me and said, hey, I don't pay you to review all these papers. I saw you reviewed like 50 manuscripts.
No.
And that's not what you're paid for. So, you know, that mindset needs to be changed. And this is beyond, again, journals, I think. So all by all, there are lots of issues around peer review, yes. And it's sometimes within journals and within publishers, but sometimes it's also with other parts of the game, I should say.
I just about the 450 movement and the notion of paying reviewers in some way, to me, that just makes me concerned about the motive for reviewing a work and making sure that you're being objective and constructive. If the motive is genuinely to contribute to science, then I have more confidence that the review will be objective. If there's a bit of a mix there of incentives, if it's genuinely motivated by money, then I'm less assured of the quality of that review. Do you know what I mean?
Another fundamental issue with peer review is that we don't have a objective quality definition of peer review, right? So how are we going to distinguish a review report that is just one line, this manuscript is bullshit, sorry, and we receive these reports and pay them 450 and then receive a review report, which is like two pages providing so many constructive feedbacks that needs to, you know, to be done by authors to improve the manuscript. They also get 450. And where is the difference between these two, right? And until there is no quality measure around peer review, which can distinguish good review from bad review, helpful, constructive from useless and offensive, again, paying reviewers won't change anything. It might even deteriorate things because you do it quickly and you get the money and that's it.
And this is the point at which I need to say that my first peer review came back with the phrase, this paper should not be published in name of journal, nor indeed anywhere else. Yes, that was a fun introduction to peer review for me.
There is a website, and I'm sorry to say it, but it's really worth checking. It's called Shit My Reviewer Says, and it contains thousands and thousands of such review reports. And actually, recently, there was a study on the content of that website, basically because authors are sharing all those frustrating review reports that are out of any help in that website. And then two researchers ran a study classifying the, you know, different aspects of these non-helpful, non-constructive review report, which actually is a good starting point to define quality because you learn things from bad ones, right? So I if you like, I can send the link later on, but it's really a nice article to read and see how common is these kind of behaviors.
You've both mentioned diversity, I think, briefly, and I know it's a really important thing high on the list for both of you. Bahar, you mentioned that there's a longstanding predominance of reviewers from Europe and North America in the reviewer pool, and this ends up having a negative effect actually on those reviewers because they get way more reviews than they know how to deal with, or certainly way more than is proportionate to the size of that part of the scientific community. What are some of the other issues, the problems that arise due to this lack of diversity in peer review?
One of the things is maybe not necessarily in physics in general, and you know, physical sciences where everything is really down to materials, but in social sciences, for example, it is very important to also engineering. It is very important to see, you know, the diverse way of looking at things. For example, I know from one of our journal editors once told me, I received a manuscript about some specific psychological problems in Indonesia, and it took me months to find some, you know, psychologists in Indonesia who could review the manuscript, because I didn't want, for example, a psychologist in the UK or in the US review something that is so dependent on the geolocation and the culture of that study. And that is one aspect of you know, introducing diversities. Another aspect is, of course, gender. I mean, in most countries, and in general, in, you know, in science, we have underrepresented academics, women academics. So it is very important to balance that, at least as a journal where we can make a difference. And one way of doing it is through, you know, being selective and also raising awareness around the gender differences in the peer review process, but also in the studies themselves. Most studies are blind about genders. In some cases, that's okay because, for example, we're talking about atoms. But in some other cases, when we're talking about cells, we're talking about clinical reports, it's quite important to also address gender over there. And in the pandemic and the COVID-19 studies, we hear that quite clearly from research community that gender is quite important. And also, as I said, cultural background in many studies are important.
Kim, do you want to add to that? I think you've been dealing some issues related to, specifically to bias that arises against authors with, say, non-European or non-North American sounding names or institutions. How do you address that?
Yeah, so there's increasing evidence. We believed at first that it was just perception, that there may be bias in the peer review process. But now, I think in the last few years, people have taken this and tried to do empirical experiments and look at whether this is a thing, and it's a thing. There is increasing evidence of bias. So, for example, one study found that if you change the country of the first author from a low-income country to a high-income country, it's viewed more critically when it's coming from that low-income country compared to if it came from a high-income country. So there's some geographical bias there. We know various studies have been done that prove that articles that are that have women as a first author are less likely to be accepted than articles that have men as a first author. And it's very difficult to prove that's absolutely because of bias. But I think that the evidence is certainly starting to point in that direction. And so we've tried to think really hard about this over the last few years. And actually, it's credit to Peer Review Week that we even started looking at this, because it was back in 2018 when the theme of Peer Review Week was diversity, that we really started to analyze the data. And we found our editorial boards are not that representative. There is bias towards the US and to Europe. And the same with our reviewer pool. And it really just started us thinking, what can we do? What's within our sphere of influence as publishers? And in some ways, it's very easy as publishers to say, well, this is a pipeline issue, right? There aren't many women studying physics, so what can we do about that? I would argue there's a lot we can do about that. We are gatekeepers of those products that, rightly or wrongly, are linked to results, to rankings, to people's careers. And so we do have a responsibility. We are part of that pipeline. We're not the end of that pipeline. It's a circle. And so if we can make sure that the work that we're putting out there is objectively assessed, that it is written by people that represent diverse viewpoints, that's a start. But we also, I think, have a role to play in putting up those role models. So making sure that our editorial boards, because being on an editorial board is a sign of, you know, you've reached the pinnacle of your career. You've been invited to sit on this editorial board. Well, if people on those editorial boards, like Baha said, are typically, you know, white men from a Western background in their 50s and 60s, that's suggesting that anybody who doesn't look like that can't make it. And that's absolutely not true. So one of the things we're looking at is making sure that our editorial boards are more diverse and are more representative. And one of the biggest things we've just committed to is that by the end of next year, we're going to be moving all our journals over to the double anonymous method. So like Baha mentioned earlier, in physics, typically it's single anonymous. So everyone knows who the author is, but the reviewer's identity is protected. We're going to change that at IOP, and we're going to protect the identity of the authors as well. And that's mainly to help the reviewers make a more objective decision about that manuscript so that they're not swayed, whether that's consciously or unconsciously, by who the author is, their reputation, what institution they're based at, their gender. We know that it's not completely infallible. If a reviewer wants to desperately find the identity of an author, they probably can in the days of Google and archive. But we hope that just not having that instant author name there will help reviewers be more objective. And we think we can trust most reviewers to not go looking for author identity, because it really doesn't serve much of a purpose.
Now, Bahar, you mentioned earlier the COVID-19 pandemic. I'm aware that there's been possibly some issues related to diversity in who's doing science, who's writing about science, who's available to review science due to the pandemic, you know, putting extra pressures, particularly on women, but also, you know, potentially the differential impact it's having on different countries and different communities within those countries. Are you seeing some of that sort of issue, Bahar?
Actually, I think it started around early May, late April, that I noticed from some of our journal editors and also other non-Elsevier journal editors on Twitter mentioning something about, oh, I see a drop in number of submissions by women to my journal. And these were journals mostly around COVID-19 topics, so health and medicine. And then later on, some researchers started to look into, for example, MedArchive, Archive, PubMed, submissions and basically look into the gender of submitted articles, manuscripts, to see whether there is any impact. And they all basically were saying, oh, there is a difference. We see that women are submitting less during the pandemic lockdown. And I thought, well, you know what? We have 2,500 journals covering all submission systems. We should be able to see this at scale and at the submission level, because PubMed or preprints are not good representative, because PubMed is only about, you know, a published paper. So we don't know how much has been submitted before getting published. And then Archive or our MedArchive, although they are really doing a great service, but they are not representative of all subject areas. And not every submitting author is putting their, you know, their manuscript in those preprint servers. And so we basically started looking at the 5 months of February to May 2020 submission rate per researcher and their gender, and comparing it with the average of 2018-2019 to see if there are any difference between women submitting and men submitting. And that is a study that we just submitted it to a journal which is not in favor of preprints. Unfortunately, I cannot, you know, point you to our findings. But what I can tell you is that we see there is an impact. In general, submissions have been increased because, of course, and in all subject areas, because many had already some research available to submit it, and then they had the time staying at home focusing on the work and submitting it. But when you focus and basically put the gender lens on your eyes, you see that women have submitted less than men, and particularly women who had been in their mid-career or late career. And that is, in my opinion, women in their late 30s or early mid-40s who possibly have also care duties, homeschooling during the lockdown, and also other caring duties like in the labs and the technicians, for example. So what we are seeing is not a nice picture, and I think it's going to have a huge impact in women career in academics in general in the next few years, because if you were not able to publish during the time that everyone was publishing a lot, I should say submitting, not publishing, because we are not looking into the published work yet. We will, but if you were not able to submit as much as the peers were doing it, then most probably you have less to showcase when you're applying for grants and less to showcase when you're in the evaluations and processes, and that is not good. So, what journals and publishers can do is to monitor these trends and also make sure that they are talking about it. It is a big thing.
So basically, to provide data to put in context those applications in the future for tenure promotion, to say, look, you know, the fact that this person only produced X number of papers, well, actually the average for someone in their demographic in their field was X minus 5. So, you know, they need to be rewarded.
Yeah, I think there should be some regulations around, you know, produce, you know, publications of people during the pandemic.
Kim, I hesitate to ask this. You know, have at IOP Publishing, have we also seen a drop off in submissions from authors who are women?
It's something I check almost on a daily basis, Margaret. I'm so aware of the work that's going on in this area, and it's incredibly important. And I'm so far relieved to say we haven't seen an impact. Like Baha says, we have seen that general uplift in submissions, but that seems to be across the board. There doesn't seem to be any particular country or gender that is less or more than the average, or at least significantly less or more than the average. So whether we've just got lucky, whether that's something that's specific to physics, it's difficult to say. And I think we can probably imagine lockdown will continue for some time yet. And so I'm not sort of saying that it may never hit us, but at the moment, we don't see any gender discrepancies in terms of submissions. But yeah, it may well change.
So we've talked a lot so far about kind of the arcane details of peer review, sort of how to reward people, how to recognize that good reviewers, how to understand what actually makes a good review, except you have the whole I know it when I see it, and it's definitely not this paper is crap. But obviously with the pandemic has really brought kind of the bigger picture into focus, because what we're talking about here is not just some sort of arcane systems based, you know, how do we do this better? It's really about sort of ensuring that research that gets out in publication is then used to, you know, make decisions about how to tackle a pandemic, what to do about public health. It's really about making sure that science is as good as possible, as solid as possible. I mean, in physics, we're probably not on the very front lines of that, because we're not doing vaccine research in physics by and large. There may be some crystallographers who would object to that. And certainly there's some good physics being done about sort of the spray of droplets and the sort of fluid mechanics of that. But, you know, there have been some kind of high profile controversies about, you know, is this science good enough? Is it telling us accurate information? How does peer review contribute to tackling and to making sure science is good as possible in this really sort of high pressure, high impact environment we're in right now?
Now more than ever, peer review process needs to prove that it is actually making sure that the science that is out there is the most relevant and precise way of the recorded and reported research. And the pandemic also showed us that peer review is not necessarily something that can happen only at journal level, but in preprints, for example, for the first time, we see a surge in number of comments around certain paper and in preprints regarding the COVID-19 topics, and that being picked up rather way quickly and quicker than the way the journals were performing, which in turn pushed the pressure on journals to be quicker and more due diligent in what they are running. So we learned a lot from pandemic, and I think in that sense, it was a good exercise.
A good exercise. Well, that's a silver lining, I guess. Kim, did you have something you wanted to add to that?
Yeah, I think it's perhaps less related to peer review, but I think what the pandemic has shown me is that there's such a need for science to be reproducible. And I think one of the ways that we as publishers can contribute to that is making sure that we encourage our authors to make their data available, to be incredibly clear and transparent about how that data was collected, to make it available for reuse if that's, you know, ethically done, to ensure that science can be verified, because we can all probably think of examples where articles have a genuine mistake has just been made. There's no intentional misconduct there, but something was misrecorded. And as a result, those conclusions are not reliable. And in the state we're in at the moment, where we really need to be able to rely on that research, I think making data availability a priority is something that we all should be taking very seriously to ensure that perhaps not as instantly as we'd like, but that very quickly those studies can be double-checked, redone, and ensure that we can rely on those conclusions. Because today, really, we've been taking the author's word for it, that, you know, this was done and this was the results you got. And okay, that sounds good. Let's take it as read. But I think we now need to be doubly sure that we can rely on those studies, especially where we're using those studies to influence health policy, etc. There's so much at stake now.
I fully agree. Data availability along with, usability. So not just dumping data somewhere without any attribution and proper description, but also making it usable by attributing, you know, all kind of things that someone needs to know about these numbers.
I think we're running a little bit low on time. Is there anything else you'd like to add?
Thank you, Margaret. Maybe I can add one more thing. That just came to my mind, and it is PIRI, second international peer review conference, which is going to be free and online starting on 29 September. It's 4 days of, you know, continuous discussion and presentation of research on peer review. So I invite everyone who is interested in peer review studies and research to join PIRI International Conference on Peer Review.
All right. Well, Bahar and Kim, thank you very much for appearing in the podcast and for talking about Peer Review Week, which runs all this week. And there are a number of activities that you can find out about by looking on the website. Just Google Peer Review Week 2020 and you'll find out about them.
No, it was indeed very broad discussion that we had, and I enjoyed it. Thank you.
Me too. Yeah, it was great. Thank you so much, Margaret, for the invitation.
That's all we have time for this week. My thanks to Kim Eggleton and Bahar Mamani, and also to our producer, Callum Jelf. If you like what you've heard this week, you can subscribe to the Physics World Weekly podcast via the podcast app of your choice, or you can follow us on Spotify or wherever you get your podcasts. Thanks for listening. Physics World.